Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Elise Glink joins us with a look today from Think Glink Media. You hear her Sunday mornings with Tom Fortino at 7 a.m. on This Week in Wealth. She's got a look at the income taxes we do and don't pay. Hey, Elise, how are you today?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. What are the numbers?
Well, it's kind of interesting, and welcome to Tax Week, everybody. I'm sure everybody's going to be a little bit busy. But tax revenue is going to provide 35% of federal revenue for the year. You know, we hear a lot about that, about how it could be more if the IRS had better computers. So perhaps with this new grant that they're getting, that will be sort of top of mind. And most of the 180 million people who pay taxes will be lower tax earners. So about 70% are expected to earn less than $100,000. In the aggregate, they earn about 30% of the income that individual U.S. taxpayers owe, about 1.5% of income taxes.
So I want to do that number again. 70% are expected to earn less than $100,000. I guess that sounds about right, because I think the median income is around $65K. So I guess 70% of us would be below $100,000. If you're north of $100,000, lucky you. And although you may not feel that way, in aggregate, they will earn nearly 30%, did you say, of the income of individual U.S. taxpayers?
Right. And so it's 70% earn less than $100,000, but over all of the income, I think it's sort of a badly worded sentence I sent you earlier today, is about, you know, people who are earning at the top, they're earning just a fraction. They're paying just a fraction of the income taxes. Huh. About a quarter of all the filers will earn between $100,000 and $500,000. And so they're expected to have half of the aggregate income and owe half of the income taxes. So the 70% number is paying a smaller fraction, right? They have 30% of the total income.
Income, yeah.
Right. But they're paying just a fraction of the taxes, about 1.5%. And the quarter of filers who earn the $100,000 to $500,000, they pay half of income taxes. And the top earners, just the top 5%, people earning over the $500,000 level, you know, they earn the rest, and the biggest amount, actually. So they're paying people earning $1 million or more, for example, teeny percent of the population, but they pay 40% of income taxes. So it's kind of interesting to see who's actually funding the government.
The people that make $1 million or more pay 40% of the income taxes that are paid into the Treasury?
Yeah.
I mean, because I think that a lot of us think, I was thinking about the first set of numbers you gave us, that 70% of the wage earners make 30% of the money. 70% of the wage earners earn more than, I'm not doing a very good
job. We're going nuts with the numbers today. I know. I wish I could show a picture for everybody, because I think it's clearer. But the biggest group of people contribute the teeniest slice of income taxes. So we hear a lot about how we lower income taxes and how this is going to benefit people who earn who don't earn billions of dollars a year, right? But the reality is that the vast amount of people who are paying taxes, right, 70% of all taxpayers are only contributing a small slice of the total amount of income taxes that are going to fund the federal government. And rich people, as you would hope for, rich people are contributing the biggest amount.
Yeah, I won't say that's counterintuitive. That is actually how it should be, but that's not the way the story gets told. We're often told that the rich aren't paying their fair share. This would make it sound like, maybe as a percent of their income, they aren't paying as much as we'd like. They sure are paying a lot. A high percentage of the total money that the IRS collects is, in fact, coming from those very wealthy individuals, like you said, as it should be.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with, really rich people paying more than what is, I don't know what a fair share is anyway, right? They're paying, what they should pay in order to fund the government and
hopefully,
to
Hopefully, but I mean, they are trying to hire more IRS agents to try and get people who are cheating on their taxes. And I don't have a problem with that. I think if you're cheating on your taxes and you get caught, too bad for you. I'm not interested in going after the cash economy that some very low wage earners are scrambling by on. But if there's people that aren't paying their fair share in taxes, then they should pay their fair share in taxes. That's not a mean stance to take, Elise.
No, it's not at all. I think that people, what we're seeing, of course, is that when people are using every legal available means to pay as little as possible, I think that's fine as long as it's legal. I would like to see people, pay what they need to pay in order to keep the federal government going. I think the federal government's a very useful thing to have.
You also noticed that mentioned in your note to us, and we'll pick it up here in just a minute, that the Biden administration is proposing to raise the percent of taxes that Americans pay earning over a certain threshold. Let's pick it up there in a minute on WGN. Lise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. A minute ago, I confused things a little bit, but here's just some of the statistics we've been passing along. Individual income taxes, the amount of money you and I pay to the IRS. Individual income taxes are expected to provide 54% of the federal revenue for 2022. And if you just draw a line in the sand at $100,000, 70% of us are making less than $100,000. That 70% of us are providing 30% of the IRS receipts. The 30% who make more than $100,000 provide 70% of the income to the federal government via the IRS. And in fact, the top earners will owe the most compared with their share of income. A small group of people, maybe 900,000 filers, earning $1 million or more, will have 16% of the income, but will owe nearly 40% of income taxes. So, Elise, you gave us those numbers at the start of this show today, and there's a flip side to that, which I'm not putting my finger on right now, because I think a lot of us think, no, wait a minute. The truth is the rich people are not paying their fair share. But this makes it sound like, in fact, they're paying a lot of the federal revenue.
So here's where that discussion comes into play, John. And I think Warren Buffett has put it to, he says it the right way, which is that even though the richest people are paying the most, the percentage of income they pay is about the least. So if you look at your net amount that you pay in taxes, you might actually pay 20% or 25% or maybe even pay 32% in tax. But really, really rich people might only pay 13% or 17%. And so they make a lot of money, they pay a lot of money. But as a percentage share, it's typically lower than the vast majority of people.
And that's the difference I did not put my finger on. I'm glad you pointed that out. With taxes top of mind now, what's the Biden administration proposing to do?
Well, I think that they're proposing to shift some things around so that rich people pay just a little bit more and everybody else maybe pays a little bit less. Although we're going to see what happens with the budget discussions that are underway. The Republicans are off to, I think, Wall Street to try and sell whatever it is they're trying to sell. We'll find out about that soon because guess what? We're all going to run out of money pretty soon. So the Congress is going to have to do something in the next month or so. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about that. But way before that happens, John, everybody's going to have to pay their taxes this week or make sure that they've got their extensions filed.
The threshold at which the Biden administration is proposing some people pay more in taxes is $400,000, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct. And, they are saying that people who earn under that amount will not see any increase in their tax bill, and people over that amount will. It's very simple to the Democrats.
Yeah, I wonder. If that's a pretty high number. The number that I don't think is as high as it used to be is $100,000. I think all of us grew up thinking, boy, if I could ever make $100,000 someday, I would be rich. And you will be better than most people. But $100,000 is not what it used to be. Put it this way, I think people who are making more than $100,000 have a legitimate gripe when it comes to the taxes they pay, the services they get for it, the cost of trying to buy a house and a car and put a kid through college, the things we want them to do, $100,000 does not easily accomplish anymore.
No, and it's interesting that you bring that up. There was a story that came out today, and I don't know if I can put my finger on it, but there, Bloomberg had a story that $300,000 of salary actually feels like $100,000 in the priciest neighborhoods of the country. Chicago is not on that list, but if you look at a whole bunch of places in California, the East Coast, and Miami, you know, living on $100,000 doesn't feel like $100,000 anymore. You really need $300,000 to feel like you're earning $100,000 the way you and I think about it.
Well, that's an interesting point. I'm trying to remember now if it was income taxes at the federal level, but there has been a conversation about prorating it based on where you live, so that if you're in Honolulu or San Francisco or New York, you should pay less in taxes because it costs you more to live there for, say, the same essential federal services you get. But if you're living in Oklahoma, maybe you should actually pay a little more because the cost of living is so much less.
Yeah, that's a little bit about what companies have tried to do during the pandemic. When people decided they were going to work remotely, they were sent home, and then some people said, okay, well, as long as I'm remote, I can be remote from anywhere. I don't need to live in San Francisco. I'm going to go to Boise, or I'm going to go to Great Falls, Montana. And suddenly the cost of living changed dramatically for them. And so the companies like Meta said, well, if you move there, we're going to pay you 20% less. And that got some people to go back to San Francisco. And some people said, hey, I'm still making out like a bandit, so yeah, I'm going to stay where I am.
We're out of time, but Lee Sklink with Tom Fortino talks on WGN Radio every Sunday morning at 7. The show's called This Week in Wealth. We'll be listening. Thanks, Elise.
You bet, John.
Let's talk about this story. So Jim Dahlke is joining us, as he often does, the national editor at American Inno. ChicagoInno.com is the local website. Talk about Outcome Health. What's happened here?
Yeah, you know, the story of Outcome Health really is the story of a high-flying, promising Chicago startup that crashed and burned. This was a company that was really lauded as a bootstrap success story in its early days, until it raised around $500 million in 2016 from Goldman, Google's parent Alphabet, Pritzker Group Venture Capital, and some other top startup investors. You know, the controversy really began in 2017 when a Wall Street Journal investigation revealed some alleged fraud of the company. Outcome, made these digital screens that were installed inside doctors' offices and waiting rooms and exam rooms and sold advertising to pharmaceutical companies. So while you're sort of sitting there waiting for your doctor, you get served an ad about a pill or a treatment. So, Outcome's executives end up getting charged, and the trial finally played out over the last couple of months. And, in the trial, it came out that Outcome indeed sold advertising inventory that the company did not have and then under-delivered on its advertising campaign. So basically, it told advertisers that it had more screens inside doctor's offices than it actually had. And sort of despite these under-deliveries, the company still invoiced its clients as if it had delivered those ad campaigns completely in full, resulting in about $45 million of overbilled advertising services. So it in turn then used those fraudulent numbers to misrepresent its revenue for the years 2015 and 2016. It was able to obtain about $1 billion in outside investment capital, including some debt and about, as we mentioned, that $500 million in VC funding that really got it some national recognition. You know, Outcome was really poised to be Chicago's next big startup hit. Rahm Emanuel, sort of infamously now stated at a press conference that, as Outcome goes, so goes Chicago. Chicago is this city that so desperately, wants its startup community to do well and its tech successes, to really, drive, a lot of, financial outcome for the people in this community to continue to grow the startup scene. Groupon, of course, was the big flashy one years and years ago, and we all have sort of seen where Groupon has gone, and Outcome was kind of expected to deliver these this next major startup hit for Chicago, and it certainly did not happen. It's also an indication that the federal government is saying, hey, startups, fake it till you make it no longer flies. We've seen that, obviously, with other cases like Theranos.
And there's
more to come, I would imagine, as the feds say, hey, whoa, let's when there's no more fake it till you make it in startup land.
But this, but it's not just that they underperformed. I mean, the allegation was that the CEO and the president were also skimming, right? Your Alex Zorn's story says the Department of Justice investigation said that of the $487 million equity investment, $225 million went directly to the CEO and the president. Were they just taking money out of the company that way?
So that was, you know, that was written as a part of the deal, and that is unusual. That was really kind of what I think caught a lot of people by surprise when the details of that came out at the time, was that it's not very normal for, an equity deal to be written in that way. And so that definitely raised kind of a lot of eyebrows. And then, not only in the equity financing that the founders received some money, but they also did in the loans they received as well. So they got about $500 million in loans, $38 million of which went to the founders directly, according to the filings during the lawsuit. So those are certainly irregular. I mean, it's not exactly what you see, right? And so that, I think, set some alarm bells off for folks, and then kind of unearth these other details. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, this is an unfortunate story. I think that, like I said, a city like Chicago, didn't really need this sort of black eye on its startup community as it looks to kind of grow in its prominence nationally. But we're starting to see different cases like this, right? The startup out of New York City, we've called Frank, a fintech startup that's being sued by its investors as well. So, I mean, hey, look, like I said, the fake it till you make it mantra that startups sort of lived on is really no longer flying.
It's too bad because it sounds like an interesting business model. Does that company still exist? Are those screens still delivering ads in doctor's offices?
Yeah, so they actually did merge with another company a few years ago. Its branding has gone away, but it had a competitor who was doing something similar that it sort of got absorbed by. So the Outcome branding no longer exists anymore, but that business model is still out there, and it's likely that, you know, when you're sitting in your exam room or your waiting room, you might see some similar technology and some similar ads being delivered to you.
Talk to me about S2G Ventures.
Yeah, this is a really interesting VC fund in Chicago, really focusing specifically on the climate. So, renewable energy, clean energy. You know, just this month, they launched a $300 million fund to help invest in more renewable energy projects. This comes after, a 2021 announcement where they, raised another huge fund to invest specifically in ocean tech. They've got about $2 billion in assets under management, where they're really in kind of investing in this next wave of climate technology and renewable energy. And it's actually led by Chuck Templeton, who is the founder of Open Table. Open Table, kind of an interesting Chicago tech story. It was never a Chicago business, but its founder has always been based here. This is a little bit of a Chicago tech trivia for you. But Chuck Templeton is now on to S2G Ventures, which he's been running since 2014, and really investing some serious cash in renewables and startups that are tackling these very cash-intensive spaces. So S2G Ventures, new $300 million fund, definitely one to watch in Chicago.
I'm out of time, but I want to direct people's attention to ChicagoInno.com. There's a story why Chicago could be poised to be a leader in urban drone tech. Let's you and I talk about that next Monday. But in the meantime, you can read it online now. And it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for the help, Jim.
Thanks, John.
Jim Dahlke, national editor at American Inno, ChicagoInno.com. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Ben Tobin, big box store reporter covering Walmart at BusinessInsider.com. Ben, you're on WGN. Thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We're all well aware in the Chicago area that Walmart is pulling half of its stores out. And one of the things that you all and others have been reporting is that Walmart says that they have not been profitable, these stores, for 17 years, that they lose tens of millions of dollars a year, that the annual loss is nearly doubled in the last five. Am I missing something here? That almost doesn't sound possible to me. It almost doesn't sound plausible to me. Are you surprised by this?
Yeah, you know, I've been covering Walmart closures across the nation with a few of my colleagues for some months here, and it is extremely, and I'll emphasize again, extremely rare that Walmart puts out a press release to talk about these closures. So I was very surprised to see the press release in the first place. I guess they knew the blowback and controversy that this would cause. But yeah, I was definitely surprised to see the tens of millions of dollars per year. That's a lot of money to go. And I know a lot of people have been asking questions insofar as why has Walmart invested even more into these stores in the past few years if they had been so unprofitable in the first place. So yeah, it definitely took me aback to see that in the press release.
I mean, listen, I'm not calling anybody a liar here, but I don't believe that you've not been profitable for 17 years and you've been operating these stores at a loss for a decade and a half. If that's true, God bless you. But I think there's more to this story than they have revealed, and I don't know what it is. But back to why these stores were unprofitable. Is it because of theft or some things else? How is it that they weren't profitable all along?
Yeah, and it's, I haven't gotten further detail from Walmart on the exact nature of these closures. They keep that pretty close to the vest. Again, this is the most they've really revealed that these about the profitability. But yeah, it could be a mixture of a few things. The rationale could be shoplifting and theft. That's something that they've been emphasizing. A lot of retailers have been emphasizing as a big problem. It could be that these were neighborhood markets, the majority of them, that those tend to be lower margin stores, predominantly selling groceries. You have to sell a lot more groceries to earn a profit than if you're selling electronics or hardware, furniture, other things that are offered at the supercenters. It could be the investments pouring in and just not seeing the return on investment to reopening some of these stores. So it could be a whole hodgepodge of things. I'm not in the Walmart business room, so I can't say I know for sure. But yeah, it could be a variety of reasons.
It's not just Chicago that they've been closing stores, though, right?
Yeah, something around I think 20 stores across 11 different states. Or there's been closures in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There've been closures in New Mexico. There've been closures in Florida. So no, it's not, and in Washington D.C. So not just. Chicago's not the sole, urban area that has seen closures. There was a closure in part of D.C. for a store that I believe has been open for around 8 years or so.
I don't know when the employees in Chicago found out, but we all found out like on Monday that this was going to happen Sunday. In fact, it was this past weekend then that the Walmarts in Chicago closed, the four of them on Cermak Broadway, Cottage Grove, and Stewart Avenue in the Chatham neighborhood, that big superstore there. And people say folks are coming and going from that like any other Walmart all the time. So maybe it's theft, but I really don't know that theft in Chicago is different than theft in Portland or San Francisco or Milwaukee or anywhere else. So what happened here? And Walmart is being mum about the details. Do the workers then just lose their pay that day, or do they get some sort of, what do you call it, payment after the fact?
Yeah, so I'll say to that point too. The first time I've covered a Walmart store closure was when I worked for the local newspaper in Louisville, where I'm based, the Courier Journal, a very popular Walmart supercenter in Southwest Louisville, closed, and that's exactly what people were saying there too. That it seemed like the store was packed constantly, and they were very surprised that the store was labeled as underperforming by Walmart. So it's a question I've been curious about too. What exactly goes into the decision making? I'm sure. That's the biggest question for a lot of people in Chicago and across the nation. But to answer your question, as far as the store workers, I believe that they're given the option to transfer to another store. And if they decide not to do so, if I'm looking at the press release right now to make sure I have it right, they'll be paid until August 11th unless they transfer to another store. And even after August 11th, they say eligible associates will receive severance benefits. Ask a little bit more about what the severance entails and if this is, different from what other employees are offered at closed Walmart stores, and did not receive much more clarity on that. But that's, if an employee at one of these Walmart stores chooses not to transfer, it looks like at least they will be paid until August 11th.
Which is maybe a deal. Some employers don't give employees 4 months of pay while these people try and find work. But it's not just the work they're trying to find. It's the products that Walmart has provided. Now, we're wondering who's going to step in and fill that gap. But it's, Walmart's business is to be profitable. But it's amazing to me that Walmart couldn't figure that out in a densely populated metropolitan area. Any other thought about that, about their inability to make these stores go?
Yeah, I know it's been a struggle for the company to figure out exactly what works in densely populated urban areas. You most commonly find Walmarts dispersed across the nation, right? They're the country's largest retailer, but predominantly in rural areas, maybe suburban areas. And they've tried expanding into more of these cities, in the past, let's say, decade, two decades, and just seems like there has been a little bit of a retreat, as we're seeing, Chicago's the most dramatic example. But yeah, then in D.C., there's no Walmart neighborhood market or supercenter in New York City. It seems like they've, whether it's the price of products to sell, if it's the price of rent, if they are renting a building, if it's shoplifting, it seems like I hear what you're saying, that it seems like there were a lot of customers at these stores, but for one reason or another, it seems like Walmart hasn't quite cracked the formula for how to successfully run one of these stores in the city.
Ben Tobin is a big box store reporter covering Walmart and the likes at businessinsider.com. Okay, Ben, out of time. Thanks for your thoughts today. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch.